Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we got some great news for you.
Well, I don't know how great it is, but it's news.
We got some big news. Also, I wanted to say we were going to have Larry Dorman on tonight, but we're going to have him on for half an hour tomorrow night.
Yeah, it was a little more convenient for him to talk with us tomorrow night. He'll be talking from his home, whereas if he was on tonight, he'd be... He had a late function, and he'd be have to talk on his cell phone
minutes,
while driving.
Tomorrow we'll be doing about a half an hour with him.
And so that was good of him.
So he's with the AFSCME Union, and we'll be doing updates with him. And
he's our regular contact with AFSCME.
Right.
And
so,
he's their public affairs coordinator.
Right. So first article I have tonight is I thought it was pretty interesting because this is from, I meant to tell you where it's from, it's theexaminer.com, and really kind of an interesting article. It says, the U.S. War murdered 20 to 30 million people since in World War II. Arrest today's war criminals.
By Carl Herman.
Yeah. And it says, U.S. covert and overt criminal wars of aggression caused 20 to 30 million deaths of human beings since World War II, according to the outstanding documents of James Lucas of countercurrents.org. The U.S. Use support of armed attacks is documented in 37 countries and in direct violation of treaties after both world wars. To forever end armed attacks unless first attacked by another nation's government. The end of this gruesome and psychopathic history of armed attacks and war murders in the Orwellian names of unalienable rights and freedom will end upon the demand of enough of the 99% to arrest the obvious current war criminals.
What will you think, say, and do at this historic moment in U.S. history? What would make your family and you most proud with consideration of your relatives who sacrificed dearly in wars? What is the future you will work to earn, the continued path of lies, destruction, and death of the 1%, or building a brighter future for 100% of the Earth's inhabitants? As you know, choosing 100% demands your intellectual integrity and moral courage to help expose and end the crimes of the current 1%. So this question is more, what is your life really for?
Right. And goes to this article, Arrest the Obvious the War Criminals.
Hmm.
And I'm going to just go to this.
All facts prove U.S. war criminals, there is no refutation, so where are the arrests?
Wait a second here. I'm getting kind of, there we go. All right. War law and constitutional rights are central to competence in government, citizenry, and military. The U.S. Constitution provides multiple protections of the first unalienable rights of life from government murder. The U.S. Constitution is the very definition of what it means to be an American, as you know. Because all facts prove beyond a doubt that a 1% in government, the complicit liars in corporate media, have engaged in criminal wars of aggression, and to date there are no documented refutation of these facts. The elegantly simple solution to war crimes is arrest of the obvious leaders.
Justice under law works with prima facie evidence. That is, if obviously valid facts are unchallenged, they are our best understanding. When law enforcement that currently serves the criminal 1% achieve this, Emperor has no closed transformation, they will exercise their arrest authority.
Here is war law. My colleagues and I have not found refutation of what it says or means. It is unlawful for a nation to use armed attack unless another nation's military has attacked. Our connections are throughout government, academia, and our collective readership is in the literal millions. That link also explains the facts from our own government agencies, official reports of wars on Afghanistan and Iraq. Those facts reveal those two wars as not even close to lawful. My colleagues and I have never found refutation of the case of unlawful wars or a clear explanation of how the wars are lawful, given what war law means.
Please submit links if you'd like to communicate to the readers of any known refutations to the documented facts here. U.S. military have oaths to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Military are also trained to refuse unlawful orders, with officers trained to arrest those who issue them. There are no lawful orders in our unlawful war. I'll address all claim refutations here again. Here is a summary of the tragic comic official reason for wars that claim self-defense. These reasons are damning testimony of official guilt.
The U.S. admitted the Afghan government had nothing to do with 911. The U.N. Security Council resolved twice for international cooperation for factual discovery and arrests of the 9/11 criminals. The U.S. demanded military access to Afghanistan. Afghanistan agreed to arrest anyone upon evidence of criminal involvement. Bush, there is no need to discuss evidence. And said there's no need to discuss evidence. And, of course, refused another nation's military into their country. The U.S. violated the legally binding resolutions and constitutionally binding treaty by armed attacks, invasion, and occupation.
The U.S. admitted Iraq had fire that only they had the authority to remove. The U.S. lied about enriched uranium, aluminum tubes, links to terrorism, and all weapons, all in an Orwellian contradiction to all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies' written work. The U.S. lied about all best intelligence to push lies for months, then violated war law to attack, invade, and occupy.
This cites the official U.S. position that war on Libya was lawful, and it's easy refutation as the opposite of lawful. This is an important addition to anyone interested in the first unalienable right of life from government murder. Here is the U.S. government claiming it can constitutionally assassinate Americans upon the non-reviewable dictate of the leader, as these criminals take psychopathic steps to murder Americans who expose their crime. And then they show, here is the NDAA 2012, which is a new bill that came in,
mm-hmm.
where the U.S. government claims it can constitutionally disappear Americans and then appoint a tribunal with death sentence authority unless unlimited detention is their choice. Here is the 2006 Military Commissions Act that say the same. And this is more fascist terrorism to silence Americans from communicating to the 99% that the 1% are war criminals to arrest now. Here is U.S. Government claiming it can constitutionally drown, waterboard anyone they declare a terrorist as a 1% terror tactic to silence Americans.
So let me be perfectly clear. Citizens of the 99% command the facts of these war crimes and demand arrests of the obvious criminals in government and their lying media accomplices. Military and law enforcement of the 99%, please end the war murderers of millions, harm to billions, and looting of trillions of the 99% wealth to the criminal 1%. Exercise your arrest authority for obvious criminals engaged in the worst crimes a nation can commit, war and looting. Professional educators of the 99%, how are you teaching U.S. war crimes and the destruction of the U.S. Constitution? Or can you refute the facts, my colleagues, and I find, as a emperor has no clothes, obvious? Have the intellectual integrity and moral courage to do your job of teaching facts and refuting obvious and egregious lies? with great respect and appreciation for the contribution you'll all make to justice under law.
All right. And I want you to go to this because he highlights a number of the articles and facts. And this, again, is examiner.com. So we'll go to that. I thought that was kind of interesting. It's time they should do something. They should just arrest these bastards. I like this story that at least the British are standing up to the Israelis, people in general,
Maybe not the government, but
not the government, but the people are taking a part in it. They're banning.
This is from Desert Peace.
Yeah, Desert Peace. Brits say no to apartheid on stage, and they state we ask the Globe to withdraw the invitation so that the festival is not complicit with human rights violations and the illegal colonization of occupied land. Israeli theater must be removed from London Festival, top UK cultural figure says. In an open letter published in The Guardian, leading directors cite that they say what they say is Habima's shameful record of involvement with illegal Israeli settlements. In an open letter published over the weekend, dozens of prominent members of the UK's theatre and film industries protested the inclusion of Israel's national theatre, Habima, in an upcoming Shakespeare festival over what the signatories say was the theatre's shameful record of involvement with illegal Israeli settlements.
The letter, which was published late last week in the British newspaper The Guardian, was signed by such leading cultural figures as film director Mike Lee, actress Emma Thompson, and actor-director Richard Wilson. In it, the signatories write of their dismay and regret over Habima's planned run of The Merchant of Venice at the Globe to Globe Festival due to take place this May, citing the National Theatre's willingness to play at settlement cultural halls despite a boycott by several Israeli actors and playwrights. Last year, two large Israeli settlements established halls of culture and asked Israeli theater groups to perform there. A number of Israeli theater professionals, actors, stage directors, playwrights, declared they would not take part, the letter said, adding, Habima, however, accepted the invitation with alacrity and promised the Israeli Minister of Culture that it would deal with any problems hindering such performances.
By inviting Habima, the letter added Shakespeare's Globe is undermining the conscientious Israeli actors and playwrights who have refused to break international law. The letter added that it supported the festival's wish to include Hebrew language plays in the upcoming event, adding, however, that by inviting Habima, the Globe is associating itself with the policies of exclusion practiced by the Israeli state and endorsed by its national theater company.
We asked the Globe to withdraw the invitation so that the festival is not complicit with human rights violations and the illegal colonization of occupied land, it added. In response to the missive, Habima's artistic director, Ilan Ronan, said, the attempt to portray Habima as a mouthpiece of this or that policy wrongs the creators, the actors, and anyone who is part of our endeavor. Performing in all of Israel is not the initiative of Habima, as the letter presents, but is a result of state law to which all public cultural institutes are subject.
Yeah, well, a lot of actors refuse to
participate.
So, you break the law, if the law is wrong, that's the way it goes. So, proud of them to do that. I was having difficulty getting the audio portions of this, but it's on some of these videos. But I think I wanted to. There was a couple of articles that.
There was one by David Icke that I would like to.
Yeah, it didn't. I couldn't get it.
We'll try it again.
It's an interesting one, though, in that he attacks the Illuminati music industry.
Yeah.
And we can play that. It's about 10 minutes long, but I'm hoping I can get the audio portion of it. For some reason, it wasn't coming out quite.
Why do some artists do have a certain amount of talent, some not very much. Why did they get picked up by the corporations to become these big influencers of young people and other people through the entertainment and the music industry, and others with incredible talent never get off the ground? It's because they are chosen.
By accident.
Right, and they were showing all these symbolisms and mm-hmm. everything, and Illuminati symbolism. So, you know, the Illuminati industry is there, and it, in the music industry, and it promotes sexual and, satanic things constantly.
Rituals and...
I like this. There's a quote here. It says, "You assist an evil system." It's by Gandhi. "You assist an evil system most effectively by obeying its orders and decrees. An evil system never deserves such allegiance. Allegiance to it means partaking of the evil. A good person will resist an evil system with his or her whole soul."
We've got to forward that to Gail.
Oh, I think so. Mm. So unfortunately, I can't, but you know, just have a forwarding thing. Just inside, but
our friend is quite courageous, and that would be appropriate saying for her.
Yeah, this is happening in England, and it's not. And it was really quite disturbing to read. And I'm afraid they're going to be doing that here, even though, Obama, his wife is involved with
nutrition.
It's still questionable whether or not that's going to, you know, what that means. Although I did read that, pink slime companies,
mm-hmm.
are filing bankruptcy.
Really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. "Children are going hungry. School meals are made smaller to save money," and this is in England. "School meal portions are being shrunk, leaving children to go hungry, teachers and parents have warned. Smaller portion sizes caused by cost cutting reported in schools across the country and are of particular concern given the increase in the number of impoverished pupils who rely on school lunches as their only hot meal of the day. Primary age children, in particular, are going hungry after being given lunches that are too small, according to teachers. The findings of a study by the Association of Teachers and Lecturers were confirmed by individual teachers and parents groups who hold the independent who told The Independent, which was a newspaper in England, it was a growing problem that had to be addressed. Children are going hungry in schools, and we all know what hunger does to your ability to learn. And it is no surprise in the current economic climate, there has been an increase in the uptake of free school meals. For some children, it may be the only hot meal of the day.
Figures from the school food trust show that the number of children eligible for free school dinners increased by 43,000 to an estimated 1,055,000 in 2010 to 2011. More than a third of education staff have reported an increase in the take-up of free meals since 2007. In the ATL survey, teachers warned that private providers who are often hired to supply school meals were cutting portion sizes to make their budgets go further with their new contracts. The younger children pay the same price but get much less than the older ones, said one reception class teacher in Brantford. Also, they do not get the choice as this is also safe for the older ones.
Another primary teacher added, "There are occasions when the portion sizes is very small, and there have been times when portions have run out. In early years, teachers said children who come with packed lunches eat a lot more at lunchtime. Another said some meals are delicious, others are far from it. The portions served to the children are very poor, and there seems to be no regular inspection of the food kitchens or portion sizes. Margaret Morrissey of the pressure group Parents Out Loud said it had received similar complaints from parents. Providers would rather cut back on quality, quantity, than put up their prices because they fear a rise in costs would lose them the contract, she said. Instead of increasing the price, they have cut back on quantity and quality.
Mm-hmm.
Councils should monitor providers very closely because many children, especially the young ones, have this as their main meal of the day. It is important that the meal is of good quality. Claire Kellett, a teacher working in Somerset, warned the education secretary. Children don't have to read Dickens. Yes, Mr. Grove, they're living it. And teachers say that those pupils whose families pay for their school bills are simply receiving less for more. In all, 62% of teachers surveyed at the ATL said meal prices had risen by up to 50 pence a day or 95 pounds extra a year. In some areas, nearly half, 44% of the teachers surveyed believed all the primary age students should be entitled to free school meals. And a spokesman of the school's food trust said, our research proves that school food is particularly sensitive to change in price.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these tough financial times, access to decent food for children has become so important. So they're actually cutting back portion sizes and food quality in the English schools. And, of course, they're doing that here.
Oh, yeah.
You all right?
Mm-hmm.
This was really fun to read. Do you want to read this or part of it?
Indiana governor.
Indiana governor signs bill allowing citizens to use deadly force against police officers into law.
I'm not sure that's such a good thing.
I thought that was really interesting that they did that, and I don't know why. And maybe they have a big problem in Indiana.
It made me kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah. Because what's going to happen? I mean,
then they just get out more police to
battle? Police will be ready to shoot instead of
talking
to people, you know. And people will feel like they can just kill, you know. So, not a good idea, but...
Addicting info, the knowledge you crave. That's
the group.
Republican Governor Mitch Daniel has signed Senate Enrolled Act 1 into law in Indiana. The new law allows citizens to use deadly force against police officers they think are illegally entering their homes. Early this month, Addicting Info reported that the bill had passed the Senate. Republicans say the bill is designed to keep the police safe. I don't understand that. But Democrats say the bill will lead to wanton killing of police officers. Representative Craig Fryer, Democrat, says the bill is going to cause people to die, and it's too late after somebody dies for a jury to sort it out. Somebody's going to die, whether it's a police officer or an individual who thinks that a police officer is entering their home unlawfully. People are going to die.
Fryer's colleague, Democrat Rep. Linda Lawson, a former police captain, says the bill would create an open season on law enforcement and opposed by 1,250 state police officers and 14,000 men and women in blue, brown, and green. I kind of think that's correct.
Yeah, I don't like that.
The new law reverses a state Supreme Court ruling that homeowners do not have the right to use force against law enforcement officials who they believe are illegally entering their home. According to Evansville Courier Press, an Evansville resident fought a police officer who followed him into his house during a domestic dispute call. The state Supreme Court found that officers sometimes enter homes without warrants or reasons protected by the law, such as pursuing suspects or preventing the destruction of evidence. In these situations, they find it unwise to allow a homeowner to adjudge the legality of police conduct in the heat of the moment, the court said. And we decline to recognize a right to resist unlawful police entry into a home. We declined to recognize the right to batter a police officer as a part of that resistance. While announcing his decision to sign the bill into law, Governor Daniels tried to claim that the law doesn't declare an open season on police officers. I don't know. I don't know about that. But it says today, the governor said, today is an important day to say Indiana's outstanding law enforcement officers put their lives on the line every day to protect all Hoosiers. And the right thing to do is to cooperate with them in every way possible. The law is not an invitation to use violence or force against law enforcement officers. In fact, it restricts when an individual can use force, specifically deadly force or an officer. So don't try anything. Chances are overwhelming you will be breaking the law and wind up in far worse trouble as a result. Well, if that's the case, then why the hell did you pass the damn thing?
That's why they passed it.
Why?
Because they want to create mayhem.
They want to create mayhem, yeah. But Governor Daniels is merely attempting to put political spin on a bad bill. Indeed, Daniels admits that he nearly vetoed it precisely because the bill could be grossly misinterpreted and could lead to killing of police and citizens. This law is basically a loophole for citizens to kill police officers and claim self-defense. There are many police people out there who think no police officers have the right to enter homes or property, even if there is a warrant. You get a point there. And as the state Supreme Court said, sometimes police officers have to enter homes to prevent the destruction of evidence or to prevent someone from grabbing a weapon in their home to use it against police or someone else. Sometimes police must pursue suspects in their homes. But this bill reverses that ruling and gives those suspects the legal authority to slay police officers. It's the equivalent of Florida's Stand Your Ground law that led to the killing of Trayvon Martin. In that incident, George Zimmerman believed he had the legal right to gun down a kid for walking through the neighborhood simply for being a young African-American male strolling around the community at night. Well, Zimmerman, believing the innocent boy to be a threat, I followed him and then shot him to death. Because of the Florida law, Zimmerman remains a free man because he can claim self-defense. This Indiana law will allow people to do the same thing to police officers on their property and their homes. It makes the already dangerous job of law enforcement even more dangerous and will ultimately lead to the legal murder of police officers who are just trying to do their job.
Yeah, I don't really think that's a good idea.
That's more or less what's going to happen here, you know? I don't understand why Indiana did that, but
I guess you'd have to be a Hoosier or whatever.
A Hoosier to understand that, I guess. Another one on real gun control is the people disarming the federal government. I wanted to get out of this section and go to the next because there was a great articles on this. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Active endeavor in drug trafficking.
Why don't we go to that?
It's interesting because of that. Nothing's being done.
No,
and everything is just, all these drugs are just being trafficked by the UN and the United States. You want to read that?
Yes. This is from voltanet.org. NATO was engaged in combating terrorism in Afghanistan with a UN mandate and in the Mediterranean without a UN mandate. These operations include tracking down terrorists, financing, and therefore drug trafficking as well. Yet Afghanistan has become the largest producer of heroin, and the drug is delivered to Western Europe via the Mediterranean, of which NATO has yet to seize a single gram. According to the Oriental Review Journal, the facts contradict the discourse, concluding that NATO itself is responsible for organizing and securing the drug trafficking.
We all are aware of the basic framework of the U.S. response to barbaric 9/11 terrorist attacks. The Bush's administration and the NATO launched unprecedented media, diplomatic, and military campaigns aimed to suppress the adversary inside its haunt in Afghanistan. A few remember that the U.S. Operation Enduring Freedom and NATO's International Security Assistance Force weren't the only military frameworks for multilateral rebuff to al-Qaeda. At the same time, the United States announced an unprecedented maritime operation against Active Endeavor, named Active Endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
The latter is known less as it was based not on the UN Resolution 1368, but notorious Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Stipulation, Collective Self-Defense.
Immediately after, all the operations started gaining momentum. But while the expediency of the Enduring Freedom and ISAF couldn't be seriously challenged, as the need to fight Taliban in Afghanistan was quite clear at the time, the mission and results of the maritime initiatives are not so obvious. Since the very beginning, it was announced that the main objective of the operation was to fight terrorism and other illegal activities on maritime communications. But they suddenly started monitoring only Mediterranean trade routes. In practical terms, the monitoring routes looks like that. A NATO warship or a group of such plies the Mediterranean warship. A group of such plies the Mediterranean and the Straits of Gibraltar. They check all neighboring merchant vessels through the special database, which includes a blacklist of suspect ships. If they detect a ship from the blacklist, they board it to inspect documentation and cargo in search of illegal migrants, elements of weapons of mass destruction, narcotics, etc., everything relevant to combating terrorism. Everything is seemingly okay. Well, let's recall where the main heroin supply routes from the NATO-dominated Afghanistan to Europe lie. Land heroin route through Turkey, Bulgaria, Kosovo, or Bosnia to facilitate the entrance into the Schengen area and avoid excessive formalities. The heroin packs, often declared as perishable Turkish oranges, are transported by tier-labeled juggernauts to clandestine laboratories in the south of France. Typical blue-colored containers with acetyl oxide, one of the principal precursors for heroin refinement, have the same destination.
Maritime heroin route lies via Mediterranean trade lines to the Corsica island. The packs are being transshipped there to ferries and follow the voyage to Marseille absolutely unchecked. By the way, according to the available intelligence, there are around 20 clandestine heroin refinement plants in the outskirts of Marseille.
Oh, great.
Now, to the main question, how many tons of heroin were intercepted on merchant vessels in the Mediterranean during more than 10 years of the operation Active Endeavor? Correct answer, none.
Not a single gram, and we should take it for granted that every day hundreds of kilos of heroin are being shipped through NATO's area of responsibility. Curiously enough, the Joint Forces Command of the operation located in Naples does not even collect such statistics. A couple of times, a relevant question concerning such statistics caused confusion and embarrassment among the top admirals leading the operation. There is only one piece of statistics. In 2003 to 2009, 155 merchant vessels were boarded and checked by NATO inspector teams. They did not find anything.
As we already know, the methods applied by Democrats against international terrorism in Afghanistan, we can't help asking another question. Why NATO is wasting stupendous resources on a purposeless operation? The answer is evident. Both ISAF and Active Endeavor are perfectly complying with their real mission to ensure total control over production, transportation, and the distribution of illegal drugs, critically important for the global triumph of democracy.
Hmm.
Man, NATO's Mediterranean maritime operation is divided into several patrol squares, each with specific names, right? But it goes on, and the article goes on. I suggest that you read it. It's a very, very good, and it's on VoltaireNet.org, Active Endeavor and Drug Trafficking. It just tells you how absurd the whole damn thing is, you know? How absurd it is. And, why? We'll do a little health news here. This was kind of scary.
I thought this was awful.
Wasn't that horrible?
Horrible.
Yeah. Baby Irene's dead. This is a baby receives a cocktail of 7 vaccines, loses the ability to speak, recovers with homeopathic shock remedies. Baby Irene's dad received with his homeopathic physician, Anna Eagle, about the dangers of vaccines. He certainly did not plan on vaccinating his 4-month-old daughter. On December 4, 2011, however, under a tremendous amount of pressure from the family pediatrician, he and his wife acquiesced and allowed the single injection cocktail of 7 vaccines follows: DPAT, diphtheria pertussis.
DPT.
DPAT.
That's new. I don't know what the A is. Diphtheria and tetanus.
Probably tetanus. HIV, fentanyl, polio, and
pneumococcal. It's for pneumonia.
Oh.
Polio and influenza and HIV.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Once home, she had a fever that eventually passed. The parent had begun to notice that the ordinary babbling, cooing, baby talking, and so forth had completely ceased. The baby could no longer talk. She would open her mouth and appear as if she were trying to speak, but could only manage to stick out her tongue. "She is not talking at all," reported a terrified father. "It seemed to me when she tries to make a noise, all she does is stick out her tongue. Her tongue is out a lot more now, and she is chewing her thumb and moving her tongue around a lot in the process." Racked with guilt that they did not stand up for their physician and insist on their rights to care for the child's immune system as they saw fit, they rushed to Dr. Eagle and searched for a homeopathic remedy. That's frightening how they give you that many vaccines without even, it's crazy.
Oh, I think so.
It's a crazy system. Doctors could do this.
She got homeopathic treatment.
Yeah. Shock treatment, actually, vaccination remedy.
Mm.
2 days after the shot, Irene received a low dose of homeopathic remedy for shock. The following day, she got a high dose shock remedy, followed by a remedy commonly used for vaccinosis. The next 3 months were a roller coaster of improvements and regressions as Irene received homeopathic doses of each of the 7 vaccines that caused the damage. This is an excellent utilization of the homeopathic principle that cures like. You want to read the rest?
Yeah, if you could just point out where we are because I lost my place. As of February 8th, 2012, baby Irene has returned to normalcy. That's good. She giggles, coos, screeches, and gurgles. Again, much to the delight and relief of her parents. Irene's father wishes to maintain his anonymity, which is understandable. He feels grateful that given the unfortunate experience, he and Dr. Eagle managed to help Irene dodge a major bullet, I guess so. Dr. Eagle, who works with patients across the world, urges parents to educate themselves about the risks associated with vaccination and helps them boost their children's immune system naturally. 1 in 88 children is diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. During pregnancy in the first 2 years of life, the brain is extremely vulnerable and should be protected as much as possible. Medication during and after pregnancy, especially vaccination, is very toxic to the young brain. In the book, Autism Beyond Despair, there are several examples of this. Toxic substances affect babies in surprising ways. Dr. Tina Smith, a world-renowned doctor who practiced homeopathy, once saw a dramatic improvement in an autistic girl by the detoxification of a nose spray, zolometazolin. Okay. Which the mother had used regularly during her pregnancy. Prescription and over-the-counter medication, exposure to chemical substances that are foreign to the substances during her pregnancy. Prescription and over-the-counter medication, exposure to chemical substances that are foreign to the human body and fundamentally toxic has become more and more the cause of illness. There is only one true for vaccines, but also for many of the treatments prescribed by modern doctors.
So anyway, you can get that on Natural News. Really quick.
Can you imagine giving a little baby a cocktail of 7 inoculations?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Pink slime is now found in 70% of the ground beef at our groceries. Are we done? I read this other article today that the majority of the pink slime producers have gone bankrupt recently.
So quickly.
Because so many places are pulling out.
Would you knowingly eat ground beef which contains scrap meat items such as muscle connective tissue, which has been sprayed with ammonium hydroxide? Would you want your children to eat such ground beef in their school lunches? According to recent revelations, if you or your children eat ground beef, there's a strong chance that both may be happening. Last week, former United States Department of Agriculture scientist turned whistleblower General Gerald Zimstein revealed that 70% of the ground beef sold at supermarkets contained the fake meat additive, which is commonly referred to as pink slime. The revelation came on the heels of reports that the USDA is purchasing 7 million pounds of the product for school lunches in public schools.
That's disgusting. So pink slime is taking over ground beef at our grocers and schools. Pink slime is made by gathering beef waste trimmings, simmering them at low heat to make it easy to separate fat from the muscle, and using a centrifuge to spin the waste trimmings to complete the separation. Next, the mixture is sent through pipes and sprayed with ammonium hydroxide gas to kill bacteria. Finally, the product is packaged into bricks, frozen, and shipped to grocery stores and meat packers, where it is added to most ground beef.
Oh.
Yeah.
The beef trimmings are particularly susceptible to contamination and were once relegated to pet food and cooking oil. However, Beef Products Incorporated, the makers of pink slime, commissioned a study which reportedly demonstrated that the ammonia process would kill E. coli as well as salmonella. Ever since, the study use of pink slime in ground beef has increased.
In 2009, the New York Times reported that despite the added ammonia, tests of pink slime across the country revealed dozens of instances of E. coli and salmonella. According to the Times, E. coli was found 3 times and salmonella 48 times between 2005 and 2009, including 2 contaminated batches of meat totaling 27,000 pounds. Thurstein, who first coined the term pink slime in a USDA memo, told ABC News it's economics fraud. It's not fresh ground beef. It's a cheap substitute being added in. And Zerstein and fellow USDA scientist Carl Custer both warned against using what the industry calls lean, finely textured beef. But they were overruled by their government bosses. The pink slime does not have to appear on the adulterated ground beef labels because over objections of its own scientists, USDA officials with links to the beef industry labeled it meat.
The woman who made the decision to approve this mix is former Undersecretary of Agriculture, Joanne Smith. Her decision led to hundreds of millions of dollars for BPI. The Undersecretary said it's pink, therefore it's meat, Custer told ABC News. When Smith left the USDA in 1993, she was appointed to the board of directors for BPI's principal major supplier, where she reportedly made at least $1.2 million over the next 17 years. The USDA said that while Smith's appointment was legal at the time, she could not have immediately joined the board under current ethics rules.
News of the USDA's plan to bring 7 million pounds of pink slime to school cafeterias nationwide comes just weeks after the government announced new guidelines to ensure students are given healthier options for school meals. Notably, the USDA purchase comes after fast food chains such as McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Burger King have discontinued their use of pink slime. Public outcry against the slime as perhaps led most prominently by celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, was also waged war against successfully against flavored milk in Los Angeles schools. So that's good news, you know. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was good news. Good news to me
that they're
after it.
Yeah, I hope they get on top of it with the school lunch program.
Yeah.
We wanted to go to the second page.
I wanted to do that because...
Europe is refusing the GMOs, so the companies are all moving here.
Right. I think that's important to read, too. There's so much important stuff to read. People got to know about it. BASF gives up on pushing GMOs in Europe. Moves operation to the U.S. where Frankenfoods are not labeled.
The latest health freedom victory in Europe means more toxic Frankenfoods, a.k.a. genetically modified crops, for the United States. Euroactive.com reports that Germany-based biotechnology giant BASF is officially calling it quits on trying to push GM crops in Europe, but the company's withdrawal means it will be relocating its plant science headquarters from Limburgerhof, Germany, to Raleigh, North Carolina. When explaining why BASF was pulling out of Europe entirely, Stefan Markanowski, a company board member in charge of plant biotechnology, said in a statement that the majority of consumers, farmers, and politicians in Europe oppose GMOs. He added that it does not make business sense to continue investing in products exclusively for cultivation in the European market.
In contrast to American laws, labeling of GMOs is mandated across Europe, which means that the public is able to make a choice in the latter every time they purchase food for their family. As a result, the vast majority of European consumers are very aware of the presence of GMOs and have wholly rejected them. And we would do the same thing if these damn...
They gave us an opportunity,
crooked,
but we don't.
This crooked, miserable FDA would do something about it. Similarly, Monsanto, which has met incredible resistance in introducing new GMOs to the European market, has decided to stop pushing MON-810, a variety of genetically modified corn that contains pesticides genetically engineered into its kernels. In 2010, Germany banned MON-810, and France has continued to enforce a moratorium on its planting, which has two examples of what Monsanto recently dubbed as unfavorable conditions. This is another nail in the coffin for genetically modified foods in Europe, said Adrian Bibb, food campaigner for Friends of the Earth of Europe, about the decision. No one wants to eat them, and few farmers want to grow them. This is a good day for consumers and farmers and opens the door for the European Union to shift Europe to greener and more publicly acceptable farming.
Well, I wish Americans would stand
up. Why don't we? But Monsanto and BAS failures in Europe, however, are likely to result in even more aggressive GMO push in the United States.
Yeah, they have to make up the difference.
As numerous states ramp up to pass GMO labeling laws in America, Monsanto and BASF have now directing even more of their attention to the American market, which is currently the world most favorable for the health injection of GM poisons into the food supply.
This means that now is the time for Americans to stand up and resist GMOs by pushing for mandatory labeling. And you can help support this cause right now by taking a minute to demand that U.S. Food and Drug Administration enforce food transparency for all Americans.
And it goes to just label it. Let's see. Just label it.
It's probably a petition.
.org. It is.
Yeah. You have a right to know.
Just go. You can go to justlabelit.org. Okay. Check this out. And
there it is, right there. Tell the FDA. Over 1 million people have contacted the FDA.
You want to contact them?
Sure.
Huh.
Washington, L.A. Steel, and then you select a state, and we happen to be Connecticut. Put our zip down, and our email address. And here's your message. Dear Commissioner Hamburg, I am writing to urge the FDA to require the mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods. I have a right to know about the food I eat and what I feed my family. And then you send the message.
Oh, there's more.
Oh.
In America, we pride ourselves on having choices and making informed decisions. Under current FDA regulations, we do not have a choice when it comes to GE ingredients in the food we purchase and feed our families. Labeling is essential for me to choose whether or not I want to consume or feed my family genetically engineered foods. This thing is pretty long. Okay. But anyway, it's worth sending. What do you think, Lyle?
Yeah. Send away.
Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Okay. I will send it. It is now sent.
Yep. Good.
Okay.
I definitely want my food labeled.
We have the right to know. A little two-minute video here.
Let's listen to
just
this.
Just label it. We have a right to know. 92% of Americans want the FDA to label genetically engineered foods. Watch a new video from Food Inc. filmmaker Robert Kerner to hear why we have the right to know what is in our food. Will you join these individuals and over 500,000 Americans in contacting the FDA to require the labeling genetically engineered foods? Here's two minutes.
We have a right to know what's in our food. I have the right to know what I'm feeding my family. I'm 6 months pregnant. With this pregnancy, I'm more aware of the things that I am eating, the choices that I am making. I want to make informed choices. I don't find, personally, when I'm in the grocery store, that foods that are genetically modified are labeled. And everything I am consuming directly affects this child that's growing in my belly, and I absolutely have a right to know what I'm eating and what I'm therefore feeding the child.
My mother had heart disease. My oldest brother had heart disease. And all of us had hypertension, but I just didn't really think about it. And then I had a heart attack. I was told that I had to change my diet. Lord, you are so surprised. What's in our food? Looking at the label changed my life. I feel so much better, and I really do have a right to know what's in my food.
I grew up, you know, eating meat and potatoes and, you know, my fair share of Twinkies and Doritos and Ding Dongs. And then as I started into motherhood, I truly didn't think twice about the foods that I was feeding my family because they were the same foods that I ate as a kid. When our youngest child suddenly one morning had an allergic reaction to breakfast, her face started to swell shut. It was absolutely terrifying. You know, we realized that we were pretty food illiterate when it came to these processed foods. There were also a whole bunch of new chemicals and new ingredients that hadn't been in the foods that we ate as kids. Some of these GMOs, they're designed to produce an insecticide internally in the plant and to withstand increasing doses of weed killers. Here in the U.S., these genetically engineered ingredients, they're not on the labels, so we're not able to make an informed choice. And so while the jury is still out on this, I want the right to know what I'm feeding my family. You guys, you're too important, right? Right?
I have a right to know what's in my food.
We have a right to know what's in our food. I have the right to know what I'm feeding my family.
Just labelit.org. You know, and check it out, because it's really important. It's,
sure is. You should know what you're putting in your mouth.
It's critical. You know, it's really critical. So with that, we will end that segment. And there was one other article I wanted to get to tonight. I believe it's on the other segment. Oh, this was an interesting video, too. With you folks, I'm just trying to get down here to this one here. This totally knocked me out when I read it. I was floored that it was on Osama bin Laden's death. All right. Once again, how much we've been duped. That there is no evidence, Lila. There's no evidence that of this purported death of bin Laden. Okay.
Oh, yeah, we realized that.
There was no evidence, though, anywhere, all right?
Well, then they supposedly dumped his body.
Yeah, but there is no pictures,
film,
no
pictures.
Evidence whatsoever.
And didn't they get rid of all his family?
Yeah.
I don't know where they went exactly.
It says the Pentagon has no records of Osama bin Laden's death. I thought this was fascinating. Government officials have openly discussed details of the mission to kill Osama bin Laden in speeches, interviews, and television appearances. But the administration won't disclose records that would confirm their narrative of the fatal night. The Associated Press asked for files about the raid in more than 20 separate Freedom of Information requests, mostly submitted the day after bin Laden's death. The Pentagon told the AP this month it could not locate any photographs or videos taken during the raid or showing bin Laden's body. It also said it could not find any images of bin Laden's body on the Navy aircraft carrier where the al-Qaeda leader's body was taken.
The Pentagon said it could not find any death certificate, autopsy report, or results of DNA identification for bin Laden, or pre-raid materials discussing how the government planned to dispose of bin Laden's body if he were killed.
Right.
Well, we all know it's a lie.
It was a huge lie, and you know, it's been, he's running on this as his in his campaign as the guy who killed bin Laden, for crying out loud. You know?
A horrible thing to run on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's a joke. And let's see, I wanted to get to this. Joseph Straw, reporter of the New York Times and the CIA defending
New York Daily News.
New York Daily News, sorry. August 11, 2011, said that the CIA defended its collaboration with the making of Zero Dark 30. CIA spokesman Preston Goldson said that such collaboration with filmmakers had precedent as part of the CIA's public outreach. Despite the CIA's insistence, Congressman Peter King, Chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, has demanded that the Pentagon and CIA inspector generals investigate whether the agencies breached policy in this case, in particular whether the filmmakers saw classified material or got access to personal workings undercover.
So there is a film.
Yeah, there's a film that supposedly came Zero Dark 30.
Given that, it is curious to say that at least that in response to a Freedom of Information Act request made by the Associated Press, the Pentagon says it has no records, not one photo, not one video, not even an email of bin Laden's death.
Richard Lardner reports for the Minneapolis Star-Tribune, March 15, 2012, government officials have openly discussed details of the mission to kill Osama bin Laden in speeches, interviews, and television appearances. The administration won't disclose records that would confirm their narrative of that fateful night. And the Associated Press asked for files about the raid in more than 20 separate, Freedom of Information requests.
Well, anyway, we've come right to the end of the show. It's 9 o'clock. It's an excellent article.
So, yeah, you can see it. It's not that long, but you can see it in, I'll tell you where, Fellowship of the Minds.
Conservatives Who Love America.
Yeah.
So it's something interesting to read, and I hope you enjoyed the show tonight.
Yeah.
And tune in tomorrow night. We'll have our guest, Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union. And thanks for being with us, folks.
Yep. Good night.
Good night.